Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to The Diplomat, brought to you by Newsweek. I'm your host, Jason Greenblatt. With tensions rising across the world, diplomacy is needed perhaps now more than ever. During my time as former White House Middle East envoy and as one of the chief architects of peace between Israel and its Arab neighbors, I've had the chance to witness the power of diplomacy firsthand, and today I would like to share that perspective with you. Shalom, salam, and welcome to The Diplomat. Today I have as my guest Yotam Polozar, who works with Israel. He tells the incredible story of how Israel, together with the help of the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Albania, Tajikistan, some private individuals, and some foundations, how they helped save 167 Afghans about a year ago during the fall of Afghanistan to the Taliban. Really an amazing story, very inspirational. I hope you enjoy it. I hope you learn from it. I'm Jason Greenblatt. This is The Diplomat, brought to you by Newsweek.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
So Yotam Polozar from Israel Aid, I'm so excited that you joined the show. You know, your reputation is really, really amazing. The reputation of Israel Aid, is really amazing. You have dealt with crises all around the world, Syrian refugees, Japan and the Philippines after natural disasters. You're an Israeli civil society organization. So before we get to the real topic today, which is how you pulled off this miraculous evacuation in Afghanistan, where you saved about 167 Afghans. Let's think about that, an Israeli organization saving 167 Afghans. Why don't you tell us a little bit about you, yourself, and Israel?
Sure. So, I was born in a small moshav, in a tiny village in the north part of Israel, not far from Tzfat. I never thought that I'll get involved in this kind of work around the world. I think before my IDF service in Israel, I did volunteering year working with Ethiopian Jews who recently arrived to Israel. And I think that's where I developed my passion for service, but also for working with people from other cultures and backgrounds. And that's where my real passion is. My passion is not only for service and humanitarian aid, but also how these terrible tragedies like Afghanistan, like the tsunami in Japan in Fukushima, like the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, the Syrian civil war that's still ongoing, even though nobody speaks about it, or even now in Ukraine, how can these tragedies become an opportunity to build bridges and change people's perspective? And that started very early for me and still continue until this day. So that's kind of my passion and where I'm coming from.
And, you know, you mentioned bridge building, and I'm a huge believer in bridge building. We come at it from different backgrounds. I'm an American Jew. Both of us are Israel supporters. But I witnessed also on the ground that when you begin to build bridges, people take a step back and think to themselves, at least good-hearted people, rational people, they think, oh, maybe these things that I read about Israel, maybe they're not true. So how is it that you are, how do you find yourself welcomed in these areas, knowing that you're Israeli and you proudly, I think, show the Israeli flag when you go help? Do people take a step back and think to themselves, wow, maybe this is really what Israel is all about?
You know, it's interesting because when you go to sort of these disaster areas like Afghanistan, like, you know, a Syrian refugee camp, people don't expect to see Israeli aid workers there for sure. But the responses that we got from the Syrians or the Afghans were what I call, they were positively shocked. And obviously for security reasons, we sometimes have to kind of hide our identity. For instance, in the case of the Afghan evacuation, these people didn't know that they were being evacuated by a group of Israelis until they actually left the country. Again, we didn't want to add additional risk. Once they left the country, they saw the shirts Israel and they learned it were from Israel. And actually, surprisingly or not surprisingly, they were all very happy about it and they didn't have any kind of negative reaction. And I'm half joking that now, you know, about 200 Afghans, almost 200 Afghans are sending me and my team members Shabbat Shalom every Shabbat, you know, and they're all very, very happy and very positive about it. And you find out that people are people and that people, learn whatever they learn from the media. But once they meet other people and reconnect on kind of the deepest level in the most difficult and complicated situation, you know, people really do change their perspective.
So now let's zero in on Afghanistan. It's about a year out since the rescue operations, since the disaster, almost the fall of Afghanistan, if you will, to the Taliban. How did Israel end up in Afghanistan? I kind of get Syria, a neighboring country and all that, but how did you get involved in Afghanistan?
It was actually very random. And the truth of the matter was that we do at Israel work in very remote places. We have projects in Colombia with refugees from Venezuela. We work in really remote islands in the Pacific, like Vanuatu, that was devastated by cyclones. But Afghanistan, we really, I personally, and no one from our team was thought that we actually have an added value here. We didn't have a team in Afghanistan. Obviously, Afghanistan and Israel don't have diplomatic relations. So when the Taliban took over a year ago in August, a lot of people started contacting us, and my default answer to them was that unfortunately we can't get involved. And, you know, if people will be fleeing Afghanistan to other countries in refugee camps, we'll look into it. In fact, when we were helping Syrian refugees, there were quite a few refugees from Afghanistan that we supported. So we did have some background in helping Afghan refugees, but only outside of Afghanistan. And then in late August, in one day, I think it was August, just really before the Americans pulled out, there were three phone calls that came in that changed everything. The first one was from a friend, Roni Abulafia, who is an Israeli filmmaker, whose best friend, Dana Harman, was who's a journalist, was in touch with a group of female activists, the Afghan Girls Robotics Team, who were desperate to be evacuated. And she reached out to see if Israel can help. And my answer to her was no, but let me look into it. Then another phone call came from a friend who is working with the Israeli Canadian philanthropist Sylvan Adams, that I think you know very well, who was trying to help the first Afghan girls cycling team because he's very much into cycling. And again, my answer to him was, I don't know what we can do, but let me check it out. And then the third phone call was the most interesting one because that came from a friend who is actually European from an Arab country originally, who was working with us when we helped Syrian refugees in Greece. And he told me that he had contacts in Afghanistan that may be able to kind of ensure safe evacuation. And so we partnered with this guy and again, we didn't know if it will be possible, but one thing led to another and I sort of got dived into it. And also, you know, I'm now running the organization, so I'm not usually getting involved, you know, in the actual field work, but that was very, very different. So when this guy told me he has a way of making it happen, I said, okay, let's do it. Let's give it a shot.
At the end of the interview, I'm going to ask you for some inspirational words from my young listeners, but you touch upon something really important in your last answer, which is, you know, people like Roni and Dana, who I don't know, the filmmaker and the journalist, Sylvan, who I do know very, very well. I'm a huge fan of his. He does some amazing work. Sometimes it takes a partnership between ordinary people and organizations such as yours to light something up that ends up saving lives, changing the world. So I want to stress that anybody who ever has an idea shouldn't think it's too hard, because if you have the idea and then you could partner with a group like yours, you really can make a difference. And I want to focus for a moment on who your volunteers were on the ground. Who were these extraordinarily brave people who actually managed to pull this off? Can you tell us about them a little bit?
Sure. So we had a team of incredible Afghans who were both, you know, the evacuees, the people that we evacuated, but also some of them helped us organize it. And we had this, and these are all group of kind of human rights activists in Afghanistan that included, you know, female judges. We said, you know, female athletes, the cyclists, scientists, some local leaders and local politicians, media people. So we had a WhatsApp group with them, and then we had our group, and our group involved was me, was my friend who I won't name just to keep his privacy, but who was working with me with the Syrian refugees. We had Dana and Roni, who was kind of who got really involved in this operation and was with me on the ground, and another local journalist from Tajikistan, whose name is Anahita, who was kind of a local person. We were on the ground in Tajikistan on the border with Afghanistan, and that's where we managed this operation from. It was all done on WhatsApp or Signal groups. That's how we kind of coordinated the locations, and that's how we were able to pull it off. One of the most complicated parts of this operation was that at some point we needed to create passports for some of these Afghans because they didn't have passports. So you're able to reach out to a former Afghan diplomat for another person that you may be familiar with, Sally Oren, who is the ex-wife of Ambassador Michael Oren, who's one of her friends from her time in DC, was the wife of the Afghan ambassador to Washington at that time. Now, this ambassador obviously is not representing the Taliban, but he was still an Afghan diplomat who had passports. So we were able to reach out to him, and he sent passports to us in Tajikistan, and we took these passports and sent them over the border, across the border to Afghanistan, to a group of 41 Afghans who didn't have passports. These passports, in the second, actually, evacuation we did, were so crucial because that's the only way these Afghans were able to travel. But this operation, I think, was very interesting, of course, because of the type of risks, but it was a combination of humanitarian mission and a diplomatic mission. We had to connect with so many government officials. You know, who are we to talk to all these presidents? But we, you know, got in touch with the president of Tajikistan, and we convinced him, with the help of Sylvan Adams, with the help of another Jewish anonymous foundation, to open his border to accept these people in Tajikistan. But he told us that he can't have them stay in Tajikistan. They have to go somewhere else. And that's when we reached the UAE, our new best friends. And when they heard that there's a group of young Afghan female activists evacuated by an Israeli organization, they immediately said yes and took them. So, you know, it was a really interesting combination of both humanitarian and kind of crazy intense operation and a lot of diplomatic push.
And a lot of ordinary people doing extraordinary things. You know, that passport story really reminds me of the Japanese diplomat during the time of World War II who saved Jews by issuing passports. Really quite a story.
We call this Afghan diplomat, we call him our Afghan Sugihara. Sugihara is the Japanese diplomat. And yeah, I mean, I could not stop thinking about that story exactly.
Yep. So tell us about the rescue operation itself. You know, the U.S. unfortunately failed. We all saw the terrible footage of thousands of people trying to get to the airport, people clinging to the airplanes, falling off the airplanes, a suicide bombing. I imagine when you were looking at those videos, you must have thought that the situation looked pretty grim. Yet you went ahead and pulled this off. How complicated, how dangerous was this mission?
It was very complicated. It was probably the most intense thing I've ever done. You know, we talked a little bit before about my background. I was in the Ebola. I was with Syrian refugees in the tsunami in Fukushima. But it was very complicated and very intense. And a lot of things got wrong throughout the process. But in short, the way it worked was that, as mentioned, we had our group. And we had my friend who was working with us before, who had contacts inside Afghanistan, who enabled us to secure safe passage. We realized, you know, when we saw these pictures from the airport, that evacuating people from the airport is not going to work. So very quickly, and I think in a very Israeli fashion, we kind of said, okay, let's find a different way that no one thought about before. And we said, let's do it by land. And let's do it by land through Tajikistan, which is a neighboring country that no one, no one thought of before as an option for evacuation. And so very quickly, we arranged a bus, and this bus picked up these female activists from different parts and different shelters and hiding places in Kabul and elsewhere. And this bus made it to the border. The first bus was with 42 female activists and their family members. And they got to the border pretty easily and pretty quickly, surprisingly. They passed through the Taliban checkpoints. They were covered with burqas, so no one knew their identity. And we had this local contact inside who was able to ensure this safe passage. The problem started when we reached the border because the border was closed. And we had, and that's where we had to pull all of our diplomatic connections that we didn't know we have with Tajikistan to convince them to open the border. And when we finally did, they said, okay, we'll open the border, we'll let them pass, but they have to leave the country immediately. So we had to find another country. And that's when we got in touch with the UAE, and it reached all the way to the Crown Prince in Abu Dhabi, who personally approved this group to come into Abu Dhabi. And then when the group made it to Abu Dhabi, the goal was eventually to bring them to the US or Canada. But we knew it would take time with the bureaucracy and the long kind of migration process. We also realized that there are, first of all, thousands of other Afghans at risk, including family members of these first 42 women that we evacuated. So, you know, with a lot of chutzpah, and I'm sure your listeners know what chutzpah is, but with a lot of typical Israeli chutzpah, we said, okay, one rescue is not enough. Let's do another one. And we organized a bigger group of 125 people, free buses, basically. And we thought, okay, we figure it out. We can do it just the same way, and we can send them to the border. Unfortunately, that didn't work out. And when they got to the border, the Taliban didn't let them pass, and in fact, arrested them. And that's when we had to bring in some connections from Qatar, and the Afghans themselves that we were working with were able to pull out some connections, and they were released, but the border was still closed. So we realized we have to find another way. And that's when we had to get in touch with, you know, this Afghan diplomat and send these passports. And once we were able to send these passports, and some of them were confiscated by the Taliban. So again, we had to find a way to negotiate with the Taliban and take these passports out. Long story short, we were able to arrange an evacuation flight, not from the main airport in Kabul, which was completely closed, but from another airport in another city called Mazar-e-Sharif in a northern city, an evacuation that we arranged. And again, with the help of Sylvan Adams and this other Jewish family foundation, very quickly we were able to charter planes and evacuate these people safely, this time not to Abu Dhabi, but to Albania. This is another interesting story because the Prime Minister of Albania, Edi Rama, who is a big friend of Israel and the Jewish people, decided that Albania, because of their historical role in the Second World War, again, I didn't know that, I felt very ignorant, but Albania is the one country in Europe that ended World War II with a higher number of Jews than it started.
I didn't know that either.
You see, so we both learn. It's remarkable. So the Prime Minister Rama said, we have a role to play here. And he decided to take 4,000 Afghans, including our group, especially when he heard there was a group that Israel was involved with. He decided to take this group and give him this temporary shelter in Albania, which is where our other group stayed for almost 8 months until finally they were resettled in Canada only 2 months ago, basically. So that was kind of the end of our main operation, if you will.
Typical Israeli chutzpah, we'll figure it out. And you did. And you had help along the way. The story about the UAE doesn't surprise me at all. Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed is a very sincere leader, a very humble guy. It doesn't surprise me at all that he had his hands in this personally. It does strike me as interesting. So you had the Abraham Accords, UAE, Israel. We all know about the business ties that continue to grow. Friendships continue to grow, and now humanitarian efforts. And then you have Qatar, which I like to call a country that is not yet a signatory to the Abraham Accords. And people may not realize that Israel, Qatar, UAE worked hard on this mission to save Afghans who were in a very, very dangerous state. I think that's a beautiful thing.
There's actually an interesting part that I forgot to mention on the Abraham Accords context, because once the group made it to Abu Dhabi, that's when I actually flew in and joined my team. And I remember the plane landing in Abu Dhabi at 2 a.m. We received like a welcoming ceremony that's, you know, usually saved for whatever high level officials. And we kept this whole mission very quiet for obvious reasons, because of security reasons with press and social media and all that. The first tweet about this evacuation mission came from a high-level official in the Emirati Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and he called it the first joint humanitarian mission of the Abraham Accords. So they actually saw it, you know, in that eyes, in that context, and I don't think that would have been possible without the Abraham Accords.
I think that's true. And I think that these countries are serious about making the world a better place. So I'm glad that you partnered with them on this. Let's move to the tougher part of the conversation. How bad do you think it is in Afghanistan today? And is there hope for the extended families and friends of these people that you managed to rescue?
It is the tough or the sad part of our conversation, Jason. It's the situation from humanitarian perspective, put aside human rights, which we'll talk about in a second, is as bad as it has ever been. There was huge issues with food security before the Taliban took over. It got much worse after. Afghanistan is a country that's very much dependent on foreign aid, and for obvious reasons, a lot of the governments, a lot of the international organizations are very hesitant to work in Afghanistan. Now, if you add to that the crisis in Ukraine, which not only takes the world's attention, but also take a lot of the foreign aid, and created another crisis when it comes to grain and wheat, which is the main food in Afghanistan. So the humanitarian situation is horrible. Now, with the human rights on the human rights side of things, the Taliban in the beginning, we saw that try to put a nice face to the world that they, in order to gain some legitimacy, that to show that they're more advanced, and they were at least in the beginning allowing women and girls to go to schools, for instance, and to get jobs. Unfortunately, that changed in the last few months, and girls are not allowed to go to school. Girls are not allowed to work in many of the jobs. So especially the situation of women in Afghanistan is terrible. And it's a real tragedy. And we're still getting hundreds, if not thousands, of messages and requests for help and support from Afghans, from family members. So that is really the desperate part. And again, the going back to Ukraine, it's much more difficult to get support for Afghanistan right now. It's not even easy so easy to get support for Ukraine anymore, because it's also not in the headlines anymore as it used to be a couple of months ago. But comparing to Afghanistan, really nobody talks about Afghanistan. And unfortunately, we know that media attention equals to donor attention. And so I really do hope that now, a year after, at least some people in terms of the decision making, the philanthropy community will look into Afghanistan and see the situation and will decide and will understand that, the support for Afghans, both the refugees and inside Afghanistan, is more crucial than ever.
I think that's a really important point. But unfortunately, as you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, people hardly talk about Syria, right? So much suffering going on there and not enough help. And that doesn't mean that we shouldn't help Ukraine. That's important as well. But we can't forget that there are other crises around the world that also require attention. Let's talk about you and the many others involved in Israel. What drives you to work on these critical, amazing, and dangerous, in this case, super dangerous missions?
It's a hard question. I think my personal motivation is to connect with people on the deepest level, and to try with, the limited resources and time and power we have to do some good with all this darkness that's surrounding us, and that's man-made disasters, nature-related disaster, climate-related disasters. I mean, there's so much going on. Obviously, for me, also the building bridges aspect is very important, that I mentioned before. But I think my team, the Israel team around the world, it's a team of about 250 people, Israelis and non-Israelis. Many of our team members are local members of the communities we work in 14 countries right now. I think really the motivation is pure pure energy, pure motivation to help and to work side by side with local communities in kind of the long journey to recovery. I think a lot of people know about Israel that we're kind of the Michigan, the crazy Israelis that jump on a plane whenever there's a crisis somewhere in the world. It's true. It is part of our DNA and it's part of who we are. But I think more important and think something that less people know about is actually our long-term efforts. Usually we stay with communities in countries for about 5 to 7 years to help communities, not only again in the immediate relief, but to help them build back better and to help them kind of get some, you know, build their capacity to support themselves. And again, our ultimate goal is that we won't be needed in these places. And the goal is that once we leave, the community has the capacity to support itself. And we've seen it happen time and time again.
It's a great segue to the last question. And I get this, I get asked this question a lot by my younger listeners. They're looking for inspiration. The world is complicated more than ever today, complex, dangerous, divided. It's a tough place. And people are looking for meaning. People are looking for ways to help make the world a better place. Many, perhaps most, are not the Michigana, right? The ones who are going to be able to jump on a plane and go into a dangerous situation, whether it's Afghanistan or a natural disaster place. How would you recommend that they find a way to get involved to help bring some light into the darkness?
I think, you know, I'm seeing it with the younger generation. I used to do a lot pre-COVID, at least. I used to do a lot of lectures and presentation in campuses, in high schools, both Jewish and non-Jewish. And I'm actually very inspired because I see the younger generation do really care. And I think there's so many ways to get involved. First of all, we can't underestimate, you know, and I think people sometimes when they hear me talk, they said, okay, we, you know, we want to jump on a plane. I said, okay, that's great, but we have to find a way. I mean, it's a whole system. We have a team at Israel that's in charge of our legal work or administration or logistics or procurement or finance. I mean, there's needs for working hands, not only to pull people out of the rubbles or out of the boats. We really need, it's a whole system of support that we need. And obviously we need a way to fund these operations because, you know, it's a non-for-profit and we can't, you know, underestimate the value of any kind of support. So if people want to get involved, you know, the first and the most important way is to help us continue do this work because, as I said, the needs are long-term and not just immediate. And unfortunately, the world forgot about Afghanistan and the world will forget about Ukraine, but we won't forget about these people and we will be there in the long run. And we need partners to help us in this journey. So that's number one. Number two, I do think that there are practical ways of getting involved wherever you are, whether it's in your hometown in Chicago or in Toronto, where we have a huge group of Afghan refugees that we evacuated, or in Tel Aviv or in Jerusalem. We've seen how a lot of the people who worked with Israel or volunteered with Israel or interned with us are getting involved in many other local initiatives, and they are, you know, the future leaders. So I don't want to underestimate these kind of local initiatives that are taking place everywhere. It is a movement, and I think we have a significant role to play.
Yotam Polozar, thank you. Thank you for sharing your story, the story of Israel, and the amazing work that you do, the dangerous work that you do to help save lives and make the world a better place. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jason.
Quite an incredible story that Yotam tells. The work that Israel does is remarkable. They were helped by several countries. One, a signatory to the Abraham Accords, the United Arab Emirates. Another, who I like to call not yet a signatory to the Abraham Accords, Qatar. They were also helped by Albania, Tajikistan. It was a daring rescue, but they changed the lives of 167 Afghans during a tremendous disaster. As Yotam says, people are forgetting already about Afghanistan. They shouldn't, we shouldn't, nor should we forget about Syria and certainly not Ukraine and the many other disasters going around the world. We end the conversation with some inspirational thoughts from Yotam. I hope you listen. This reminds me very much about the work that I did at the White House and the book that I just came out with, In the Path of Abraham. The title is because we are on a path. It's a long, complicated, tortured path toward making the world a better place and toward peace. Don't forget to pick up your copy today. It's available on Amazon or wherever you get your books. Again, In the Path of Abraham. I'm Jason Greenblatt. This is The Diplomat, brought to you by Newsweek.